produced by Wayne Hall, Bill Govier, Preston Frazier and Jeffrey Cresselius. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 449, Yes versus Time and a Word.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 449 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along very soon. You can get involved yourself with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site yesmusicpodcast.com. My day job has been absolutely manic this week, so I haven't had a chance to do any news or updates. So in a moment, Mark and I will get straight on with the main content. However, before that, just to mention two people. Firstly, Jeremy North, who very kindly sent in some audio from an interview we thought you might like. Here it is.
It's Rick Wakeman from his new album. It's a track called Olympus Mons. The album's called The Red Planet, and it's a kind of return. Well, it is, listening to that, very much to the work he did back in the days, initial solo albums. And we're very pleased to say he joins us intermittently. He's been hunkering down during the virus, but he joins us now. Rick Wakeman, good afternoon, Rick.
Hey, how are you doing, guys?
We're good. So how have you been? Because I understand I think you are classed as vulnerable. You've had a few health issues. So is that why you've been sort of isolating as much as possible?
Yeah, it's been a mixture of that and the family. There's been some, you know, some health issues. So we've been pretty well behaved. Well, we've been very well behaved, really. Not gone anywhere near Bournemouth Beach or anything like that. although I think that's the answer to the theatre's problem, because there's so many people on the beaches there and at Brighton, just build the stages there.
Yeah, just do the gigs there. That's not true. A bad idea.
And put a football pitch there as well. That would solve all the problems. It's bizarre, but we've had to be serious and sensible. But it does wreck the year. I mean, all my touring was cancelled, all the concerts were cancelled. So, you know, you just go, ah, okay then. Well, that's what that. And I've missed my football terribly, as we all have. And I've got to say that I know it's back, but I don't enjoy it with no crowds.
Yeah,
no, it's taking some getting used to. It's better than nothing, I think, is the view.
It's better than nothing, but you know, but you're right. But you know, it's. I cannot believe. I mean, I've heard some people on your show and on the breakfast show as well, and talking about the footballers that they miss the crowds, because they do have an effect on the way they play.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No question about it. And of course, normally
a concert with no audience.
Exactly.
I mean, normally when you've got a new album out like this, you'd be playing it, wouldn't you, so people could get to hear it.
Yeah, we'd be touring. I mean, thankfully, it's selling really well and doing well, but that's not the point. We'd be out playing. We would be out touring it and doing lots of concerts, and of course, that's gone out the window. So we're planning a lot for next year. We'll do a load of concerts next year, because this has got to stop, you know. Yeah. So, just planning for 2021, really. Mm.
You've been doing lots of different stuff. We've spoken to you about you revisited work you did with David Bowie, and you did classical stuff. But this is very much like sort of Journey and King Arthur, isn't it? This is kind of in that area.
Well, a lot of people kept asking when you're going to do another prog rock album, and I said, well, when a good concept comes up that I find inspiring, and this one came up from a great friend of mine. This is some name dropping for you. A friend of mine called Garrick Israelian. He was introduced to me along with Professor Stephen Hawkins by Brian May, of all people.
Oh, wow.
And Garrick is the guy who proved and discovered black holes. I mean, he's ludicrously clever. Try talking to him about anything else but that, and it's a waste of time, really. but it was him who informed me that we do a big festival called Starmus every year. And last year was in Zurich to celebrate the 50th anniversary of man landing on the moon. Mm. And we had all the surviving astronauts who'd walked on the moon there.
Wow.
It was pretty astonishing. I stood in front of Buzz Aldrin and didn't say anything. And he just looked, he said, are you okay? I said, you walked on the moon. I mean, this is so ridiculous. But it was. But next year, of course, is the 50th anniversary of man arriving in Mars.
Mm.
Not on Mars, but around it.
Yeah.
And there's three more missions on the way there now. And he said to me, you know, a few billion years ago, he said it was a blue planet. It had water, oceans, rivers. He said, so your mate David Bowie might well have been right. There was life on Mars. And they'll probably prove it when the new missions arrive next year.
Wow. So the Red Planet's where Red Planet came from then. This is what gave you the inspiration for the
Absolutely.
Album.
Absolutely. I got loads and loads of photos. This, the photographs look like they could have been taken with you standing there. They're so good up there now. It's so good. And I looked at all these photos, read a load more about it, did a lot of... it was just such a musical thing to write to. It was great fun.
I've just been checking. I was going to check the album on Spotify, and I came across this other new album that you seem to have released, called Hero. And it's very much football based. What's that? What's that from?
Lucky, that's a release from a company. That's a film. I was very lucky to do two of the FIFA World Cup films. I did the one in Madrid. In Spain.
82,
and then I also did the 86 one, which was Hero, which was really about Maradona, because he was the big star. 82, of course, was the famous Italy final, which I went to, which was fantastic to go to. I had they found me a seat, which was really good. I had no rights to be there, really. I was only the composer of the music. so I had a pretty good view from about 700 yards away from the pitch. It weren't bad. But it was a great game. And I did the two World Cup films, which I thoroughly enjoyed doing. And a company's got hold of the soundtrack and released it as a CD.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's the 86.
Those official films are all on Amazon. We watched them during
lockdown.
Oh, yeah,
they're good. They're worth watching. You might see yourself in the crowd in 82.
It was wonderful for me to do it. I was just sorry I didn't get to do any more.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get to go to wherever you like. I was given a pass that pretty much sent me anywhere I wanted to go. There was one match I saw with one of the Poland games where I actually went through the wrong entrance, which was an entrance reserved for players and officials, so I nearly played.
Could have come on.
Yeah, it would have been good.
Nice one. Now, you must be chuffed for Brentford, now a Premier League side. You were a director at the club back in the day, so you must be so pleased to see them up
they're
in the top.
Premier League, yeah. We wished.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, they're not Premier League. Oh, they lost. I'm sorry. You're close. Yeah. They came close.
Don't rub it in.
I'm sorry,
Rick. That's all right. Just poke me in the eye. I think along with Natalie, I was crying that day.
Yeah, understandably.
I mean, but the thing is, I think the truth is they didn't lose it in the final. They lost it in the two previous games. They actually, the two league games, it was totally in their hands. They just did remarkable. I think Franks has done an amazing job there. I just hope that the whole team doesn't get decimated, which tends to happen at Brentford. They've got the new ground or whatever. I must admit, and for biased reasons, I'd have loved to have seen Brentford up in the division. So many of my friends have said it as well, because no disrespect to your Fulhams, West Broms and Watfords of the world, but there's a lot of what I call yo-yoing backwards and forwards from the Premier to the Championship, back up and back. And I know we lost Bournemouth this year down to the Championship, and I think Brentford would have been the perfect replacement, because I think they would have gone on to have done over a few years, few seasons, what Bournemouth achieved, playing good football with limitations, and even the new ground is bigger than Bournemouth had, and I think they would have been a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I mean, look, they are good at replenishing the squad. That they find they've done it already.
They're so clever.
Ivan Toney's come in, isn't he? They've brought him. They've moved players on.
They have a scouting team to die for.
Mm.
I mean, where they find some of these players. I mean, they've done it. When you look at the number of ex-Brentford players playing in the Premiership, it's astonishing. You know, they've had so many great players, and somehow they do keep managing to replace. I just hope they can do that, because one of the things that happens is when it takes time, they get off to a bad start. Like they got off to a bad start last season, in fact.
Yeah.
They were down, I think, fourth from bottom at one stage, and then suddenly all clicks, and all credit to the directors and the owner of the club, who don't interfere, who let them get on with it, never panic. I think they lost seven in a row at one stage at the beginning of the season. Never panic, away they go. I just hope that that they can do it, because I'd love to see them at Premier for many reasons. One, I think they would be a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed they can come again. So, Rick, people can buy the album on, they can find it on Spotify and elsewhere, and they can. Is it on vinyl, CD, etc.?
It's in Tesco's, Sainsbury's, Amazon, online, Wakeman's Music of Poem. It's nearly everywhere, including good. Brighton Beach and Bournemouth Beach, along with all Marvellous. The people who are there.
And will you be getting the capes out of storage when you tour this, because it's in the spirit of the old ones? Doing it on ice?
I'm afraid the capes will come out. they have to come out.
Of course they do.
And also we're looking at doing quite an outrageous staging.
Oh, good.
And, never know, the odd Martian might appear.
Oh, exactly. That's good. We'll look forward to it. All the best, Rick. Take care. Thanks very much.
Guys. Cheers. Bye.
Cheers. Rick Wakeman there, his new album, Red Planet. Oh, yeah.
And the second mention is to Terence Tumpey. I hope that's how you pronounce your name. And he was the first person to use the special new Yes Music podcast donation page. So go and have a look at that if you'd like to. But for now, on with Yes versus Time It A Word. Yes, perhaps, were deliberately announcing themselves to the music-buying public with the emphatic speech bubble logo on the front and back of the UK version of their first album. By contrast, the UK's Time and a Word, with its Magritte-esque surreal cover, which was thought too risque for delicate American eyes, doesn't even feature the Yes logo at all. It's on the back in black and white, while the cover has a very restrained 1960s style topography. So, at least in the UK, there weren't really any clues as to these two records being by the same band, and maybe that was part of the point. The music contained on the two discs is also quite different in the main, largely but not entirely due to the expansion of the sound palette afforded by the addition of an orchestra for the band's second outing. Of course, the US had their own version of potential confusion, with band photos on the fronts of both releases, and yet more different fonts for the name. Add to this the fact that Steve Howe appears on the Time and a Word photo despite not joining the band until after the album had been recorded, and we can see that Yes's global brand identity, as it would now be known, was a little inconsistent, to say the least. At least in the 1980s copies I have of the UK vinyl albums, Yes is a gatefold, while Time and a Word is not. Inside the gatefold is a great little piece from Tony Wilson from Melody Maker, where he says he's delighted that he managed to pick Yes and Led Zeppelin for his two bands most likely to make it big. He's happy to say his choice of Yes is reinforced by what's on this first album. I imagine he's even more convinced now. The huge flower-powered photo in monochrome purple and white of the band gives the viewer an expectation, maybe, that there's a lot of psychedelia on this album, and there is a bit, but not that much. It was 1969, though, so I'm sure that was a deliberate attempt to link the band to these kinds of movements. There are similarities between the two records' packaging and contents, of course. They both have the paper lyric inserts, which are very similar, apart from the first album's version being printed in diamond format. The Yes logo is there on both, and I love this aspect of the records. Also, both albums contain two cover versions and two songs co-written by collaborators who predate the formation of the band. And as I have pointed out previously, this is one of the very few occasions in the whole 50-plus year history of the band where we have two consecutive albums featuring exactly the same lineup. Although on my copies, John Anderson drops the H in his name between the records. Today's pop quiz. Can you name any of the other times the band lineup remained the same for two or more records in a row? So, on to the music itself. I've always regarded the opening blast of Chris Squire's bass on Beyond and Before as an amazing statement of intent. The co-founder of the band lets the listener know that something is indeed coming, and we'd all better hold on to our hats. The harmony vocals are more psychedelic in character, but superbly done. The combination of Kay's Hammond tones and Banks's is fantastic, and Bruford's drumming is just right, but I wonder if Squire was trying, even at this earlier stage, to move the band in a different direction with his huge, insistent sound. The instruments overall seem to be blistering and monumental, while the vocals are a little more subtle in character, a little softer-edged. It's still an interesting and effective contrast, a feature the band would return to many times. I love the quieter end as well, with Banks's creeping lead and the ebb of the vocals. But just in case we were thinking that was it, Both a loud reiteration of the heavier material and then an acoustic guitar epilogue remind us that these musicians were trying to do something a bit different from this first song on the first album. I See You is more jazzy in its influence with some delicious Banks guitar and clicking Bruford texture. Vocal harmonies are again featured, and this was indeed a stated aim of the band, to be a vocal-based ensemble complemented by fabulous instrumental work. The production of Anderson's lead parts is handled slightly roughly, but it does pop out of the texture in a pleasing manner. The contrasts are again present, but perhaps the guitar solo feels a tiny bit out of place at first, before it morphs back into jazzy territory, which is definitely where it belongs in this song. The guitar and drums exploratory passage feels like we've stepped into a smoky jazz club, and Bruford is clearly in his element with lots of cymbals to ride and fluttering snare interjections to complement the improvised guitar work. Banks then lets rip in glorious rock style as the band all pile back in, and the listener is left shell-shocked by the mix of precision, modes, moods and approaches contained in this precursor of what Yes Music would become. Maybe not in terms of sound, but definitely in terms of ambition, drive and creative impetus. Yesterday and Today takes us in a rather different direction. Less rock band and more acoustic ensemble. It's a lovely tune with a floating melody and piano, subtle bass and touches of acoustic guitar, proving this band could turn its collective hands to intimate and beautiful music. There are hidden depths in this song, along with most of the others on this album. A lovely piece. Looking Around, however, launches us back into rock territory with fabulous Hammond organ, buzzing rhythm section and more of those wonderful harmony vocals. It's full of energy and allows Chris Squire to show off his lead bass again at various stages. A toe-tapping sing-along number with some hints of the Peter Banks live insanity. A great Hammond and bass-led ending leaves you begging for more. Harold Land yet again features dramatic bass playing at the start, combined with a shuffle rhythm, before wordless chorus leads into a somewhat different mood, which spins along to the verse. A bit Beatles-esque in its lyrics, once again there's a lot going on in this arrangement, which ramps up and up via some fascinating techniques incorporating vocals and instruments. I can't think of any other music from the time which sounds very much like this, although I'm no expert, and the virtuosity of the musicians is remarkable. It may not be your favourite song on the album, but it's certainly another accomplished piece of arrangement, a feature of the band's future output, of course. The opening material reappears at the end, but it's masterfully handled and doesn't sound like a lazy way of extending the song. As I said before, I prefer Yes's version of Every Little Thing to the original Beatles one. I think this song shows the closest playing to the live Yes experience of the time. Peter Banks is close to maniacal here in the introduction, and Bill Bruford is creating mayhem on the drums. The way the introduction moves into the verse is also beautifully handled, and vocal harmonies elevate the chorus to previously unheard-of heights. It's recognisable as the Beatles song, but it's given the full Yes treatment, extended and arranged with fearless ingenuity. Hammond gives the basis, while Banks and Squire twist in and out of each other's lines in a counter-melodic fantasy. There are moments of quiet contrast, of course, with the verses deliberately fragmented for effect. What a trip, and a quite superb cover version down to the bashed about ending. Sweetness gives us something completely different. There's a lovely Hammond introduction and then some glorious Squire bass and wordless chorus before Anderson's breathy, sweet vocals. It's definitely worth listening carefully to Squire's bass for another object lesson in creative construction and counter-melodic playing. I've always loved this song. It may be naive, but such a laid-back experience is easy to float away to on its waves of positive energy. A love song and relatively simple in construction, but another song with deft arrangement. Finally, Survival features a Squire wah-infested opening and quickly moves on to a mesmerising texture based on some great Banks guitar work. I know it's something which has been done by various bands, but it's still remarkable to hear the second mood emerge out of the other one. Two totally different songs. The new groove has acoustic and electric guitars, followed by tender Anderson vocals and more naive lyrics. A growing bridge leads to the memorable chorus, which Kay's Hammond imbues with style in its repeated figures. The vocal melody at times seems to fight against the tonality of the accompaniment, but this serves to enhance the slightly unnerving feel at these points, and paves the way for the returning chorus. More than just a sing-along a Yes tune, there's a lot going on here if you listen carefully. The end of the song and the album gives us a perhaps expected recapitulation of the opening material, but its end is so quirky and effective that it's a welcome return indeed. Moving on to Time and a Word, No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed, throws us straight into a completely different soundscape to the previous album with the addition of orchestra. As a cover version, Anderson's vocals start lower than we're used to, but one thing that remains a constant is the killer bassline stylings of Chris Squire, which are immense. The band moments are certainly familiar, however, with Kay Hammond and Banks Electric cutting through well. And then there's the integration of the theme from The Big Country. It's such an odd idea, but for me works so well here. The welcome return of the verse is so full of energy and commitment, and the orchestral ending is handled so well and abruptly that I think this is a superb opening to the album. It certainly goes by in a flash and leaves the listener breathless. Then is next and looks back more to the first album. There's a lot more band in this one at the beginning with Bruford's amazing fast snare pattern. Soon we are onto the big chorus, which is augmented by strings, but the fizzing bass lines and the striking strong vocals make this song more about the band than the orchestra for me. Peter Banks' additions are fairly low-key, but there are wonderful Hammond organ moments, and of course Squire blasting away with the usual ingenuity. It's high-octane stuff with frequent organ hiatus moments and a great deal of fun. Of course, there's a quieter section with touches of guitar and bass leaving lots of space for Anderson's vocals before a bizarre and off-putting ending. Remarkable stuff. Every Days brings back some of the jazzy feel of the first album, but this time it's Bruford's slow brushwork on snare and cymbals which provide the percussive jazz frisson. This is dreamy stuff with the feel of a hot summer afternoon, wandering around or closing your eyes after a large picnic. High-pitched strings seem to flit in and out of focus, and then a complete change begins, leading to music which sounds more like a chase scene than a lazy, sunny afternoon. If you've seen the highly bizarre video of the boys from the band being chased by a nun, you'll understand what I mean. Banks' guitar soloing becomes frenetic, complete with a snatch of Bach, and strings pile on the cinematic excitement. Suddenly we are back at the hazy, lazy mood, and this song gives us more clues as to future approaches. This is one of three songs on the album which are over 6 minutes in length. Yes, starts to set out its stall. The audacity of the final crazy moments of the song are remarkable, but maybe not that surprising given the musicians involved. Sweet Dreams is rather more of a straightforward song, with a brilliant undulating bass line and highly catchy vocal melody. Chordal shifts and a few unpredictable timings add interest, and the sense of unbreakable motion is undeniable. The middle eight, if that's what it is, brings a smile to the face, and the swing back into the chorus is a dream. Lots of Yes positivity shines through on this one. Is this the first proper fade-out? I think it might be. The Prophet opens with a wonderful Kay Hammond solo, which would have been easy to omit, but they didn't, and the song is a lot better for it, in my opinion. The main riff is set up with strings, but breaks down into a very different form to underpin another section, which then itself breaks down further until we finally find the vocals, which cut through brilliantly. It's the story of a man who goes on a development of his own, and Yes Music seems to have gone through a similar transformation during this album. Complexity has increased, and though the musicians were clearly full of ambition and courage in their first outing, it feels like they have almost found a new direction here. Almost. False ending shenanigans are fun, and Hammond and bass really combine brilliantly to create a masterful and dramatic end to the song. Clear Days is a short piece, but one of my favourites because of the piano quintet accompaniment to Anderson's beautiful melody. It's a lovely creation with some very authentic string arrangement. It feels somehow grown up, a piece I'd like to see developed further. Astral Traveller is perhaps the first overtly spacey song by the band. Banks' grungy opening chordal guitar is joined by the rest, and the effect on the vocals is distinctive, to say the least. This song could have been on the first album, I think, but it's great here, with Bill's snareless snare sound, another feature. Again, it's highly memorable without being too predictable. The middle quasi-classical organ, bass and guitar workout is great fun, and the song doesn't just crash back into the chorus. Rather, there are opportunities for electric soloing and a very fine build-up to the inevitable reprise of the main material. As always, listen out for the bass line. It's scintillating. Somewhat surreal, the ending is perfect for this odd and fascinating song. Acoustic guitar starts off the final song, which is the title track. It's apparently co-author David Foster playing it, who also, it is said, added some backing singing as well. Both of these roles were uncredited. Peter Banks was not pleased. Anyway, Yes's Hey Jude song is a somewhat simpler piece than some of the others here, but I can't help myself singing along with this one. You could argue that it's a little bit out of place on this album, as it maybe would be on any Yes album, but I still find it highly enjoyable, and I don't mind the predictable structure. I'm happy to wave my hands in the air like I just don't care, as the repeated chorus is enhanced by the orchestra and the album fades out. Perhaps a bit of an anomaly in the context of this record, but still a song I find myself humming round the house quite a bit.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be doing a segment that was very popular the last time we did it, which was taking two Yes albums and taking a close head-to-head look at the two albums. Last time it was Fragile against Close to the Edge, and this time it's going to be the Yes debut album against the Time and a Word release, which was the band's second release. Now for me, this is sort of a tough one. Almost as tough as Fragile and Close to the Edge in a lot of ways, because I came to these two albums kind of late in the game, and because of that, they were very fresh, very new to me. While I'd heard some of the songs before, like Time and a Word, and songs like Astral Traveler, I was very unfamiliar with the first record, and even though, like I said, I had heard those two other songs from Time and a Word, the whole record was something that was very foreign to me. But as I listened to them and started absorbing them a lot more, they really become favorites in a lot of ways to me. Maybe not favorites in the sort of a top 10 ranking, but that they're pretty high up there, all things considered. Now, why is that? Well, let's get into that. So let's take a quick look at the first album, which was simply entitled Yes. That came out on July 25th, 1969 on Atlantic Records, and it was produced by Paul Clay and Yes, and it was recorded at AdVision Studios and Trident Studios in London, England. Now, this album, many people kind of think that it's, you know, I don't know if immature is the right word to use, but it's very green. They're obviously very young at this time. First album. One thing I seem to notice when I listen to bands' debut records is that high energy that a lot of them have. I mean, most bands are very excited to be in the studio the first time. It's a new thing for them. It's something that they've been striving for their whole careers up to that point. So when they get a chance to go into a professional studio and do it, I mean, sometimes their excitement is overwhelming, and that seeps over onto the recordings themselves. And I think this record is one of those ones that do that. There are songs that immediately come to mind where I kind of pick up on that. Looking Around, for example, has that kind of excitement to it. Beyond and Before, you know, Chris just firing away on that bass right at the very top of it, and even Survival for that matter. You can really sense the energy in those songs. Now, of course, there's a couple of cover songs on this record. We have Every Little Thing, which is obviously a Beatles song, and then you have I See You, which was recorded by the American band The Birds. So obviously, their influences are showing on their recordings early on. And that's not a bad thing, I don't think, because a lot of bands seem to do that. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, it wasn't uncommon for bands to do these kinds of things. Now, the band sounds very well rehearsed, in my opinion, on this recording. They have been playing quite a bit, I would suppose, by this point, doing lots of gigs around the London area. The thing that I noticed right away is that John Anderson sounds like he's very comfortable in the role of the singer at this point. He has a great voice, a great control of his voice, and songs like Sweetness and Yesterday and Today are just very, very melodically sung, great emotion to them. I mean, this is something that you would maybe expect showing up maybe, you know, the next record or the record after that, when he's had a little bit more experience behind the mic in a studio situation. But he already seems to have a good grasp of it at this point. And yes, I know he did do some recordings earlier in other bands, but I mean, this is like a pretty big thing. They were on Atlantic Records at this time, and they were going into the big wide world of the major worldwide release at this point. So I think that he showed a lot of composure doing this. Now, Tony Kaye's organ playing on this is outstanding. I always thought that he was a brilliant organ player. I loved his playing on this. Bill Bruford, drumming is always good. And even back at this point, he has that signature Bill Bruford snare drum going on, which I've always enjoyed. Peter Banks, guitar playing, great. One thing, the only thing I probably would complain about on this record is I think that Peter Banks could have came up a little bit more in the mix. His guitar playing is really well done. I mean, yeah, his leads you can hear pretty decently on this, but I mean, even his rhythm guitar playing was really well done. So I think that should have came up overall. And Chris Squire, what can we say about Chris? I mean, his playing is all over this album. I still find that his tone is maybe not quite there as far as what we come to expect and, you know, hear on later recordings, but it's very close. I mean, it just sounds like it's a little on the muddy side, maybe needs a little bit more top end. And this is as far as mixing goes. It's close. It's really close. I mean, you know, Beyond and Before and Survival, those bass sounds, they are very Chris Squire-ish, but I think they just needed a little bit more polishing up. And that is something that they did work on and got, I guess, as close as possible as they could on the next record, Time and a Word. Now, Time and a Word was released on July 24th, 1970, almost a year exactly to the day of when the debut was released. This was recorded again at AdVision Studios in England, and this time it was produced by Tony Colton and engineered by an individual named Eddie Offord. Now, because of this, there is an immediate change in the production of the record. While I think the first record sounds very good, raw, everything though is kind of crystal clear as far as hearing things. Like I said, there's a little things here and there I had issue with, a little bit muddy bass guitar sounds, and Peter could have come up a bit in volume overall. I think it was a well-recorded record and sounds good, and on vinyl it sounds fantastic. This record, I think, sounds much more full. Chris Squire's bass is much more predominant in the mix. It's also, while it has a bit more top end to it and it has a bit more of that growl that we're used to, I think they might have went a touch overboard with the bass on it. Now, either that's something that I heard on this remaster, because I did listen to the 2003 Rhino reissue of this, but on the vinyl I don't recall it being as heavy, and I have a couple of copies of it, so it could just be the remaster. But in any case, Chris Squire is very much more upfront and present in this record. Another thing that came on this record was the orchestra, the brass and strings that were added to it, something that Peter Banks did not like, and his dislike of it led to his being released in April of 1970. Now, the strings are always something that people either like or dislike. For me personally, I don't mind them. The more I listen to this record, I kind of enjoy them. Certain songs, I think they add more things than others. Songs like Every Days, I think that the strings and the orchestra bits are very nice in that. Time and a Word, I think it adds it okay. No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed. I'm kind of 50-50 on that, because I think a lot of the stuff that they did on that song in particular, Tony K was doing anyways on the Hammond organ, so it's almost just like they're doubling each other's parts. So I can see why Tony K kind of didn't like the orchestra as well, because they were kind of stepping over his parts. So I don't know, I could take it or leave it with that. But I think that the strings overall and the orchestra itself did add to the sound of it. And I mean, you got to remember as well, at that time, it was pretty hip and in to have a orchestra on your record. Deep Purple did it, The Nice did it, you know, and of course the Moody Blues were doing stuff like that. So, and the Moody Blues had quite some success with that. So why not try it, right? But obviously they didn't like it enough to ever continue with it again until years and years later, when they did a record called Magnification. Now, this album has quite a few songs that I enjoy quite a bit. Astral Traveler is a song that I really, really love, and they have put it back into their set list more recently, which was a good thing. I think it's a great song, especially live. I think it's a good song. Sweet Dreams was always a favorite. You heard that throughout the 70s. No Opportunity Necessary was always a very good live song, I thought, especially when you watch those old black and white videos that they released of them playing these songs. Fantastic. And the other songs, I mean, they're good. I could take them or leave them. I mean, Then is okay. Every Days is not too bad a song. But the song that kind of now recently popped up and reared its head, and I kind of realized I like it a little bit more than I thought I did, was The Prophet. Why? Tony K and that Hammond organ. Wow. I mean, what a great job he did on that song. I really enjoyed it very much. And sometimes a song could be pretty good, but when you have a performance by an individual as good as that, it can take a song from very good to very great, in my opinion. So I really love that song. So overall, what do I think? Debut or Time and a Word? Well, I kind of look at it like this. The debut has the fire, the energy of a young band that's excited and ready to go and tackle the world and show the world what they can do with their recordings. And Time and a Word is a band that's been kind of around the block a few times now, touring a lot. They were doing recordings in between concert dates and tours, so I'm not saying they sound tired, but they do sound not as energized as the first album. But the songs are more mature, more thought out, more complex. But the orchestra, do I like it? Does it hinder it? I think it's fine, actually. The production is slightly better, I believe. So I think I'm going to go with Time and a Word. As much as I do love that first album a lot, I think Time and a Word is a very interesting record. It's a record that, you know, because we don't hear the strings in the orchestra until much later again, it gives it that sort of extra interesting element to it. And also because this record has had some interesting things done to it over the years as far as reissues. For example, they did reissue that German pressing of it, which was different than the original pressing. There's a different mix of No Opportunity Necessary, as well as Sweet Dreams on there, and Dear Father appears on the regular playlist, and The Prophet has been removed from the track list on the German pressing. So, you know, we got some interesting things going on with this record, historically speaking. So it kind of, you know, had my attention a little bit more than the debut record. So yeah, I think I'm going to stick with Time and a Word as the one that comes out on top in this comparison. But let's go talk to Kevin now and see what he thinks.
So, yes, versus Time and a Word, for what it's worth. And Mark is here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good.
Excellent. Okay, then. Well, I really enjoyed listening to the first two albums in the Yes catalogue this week. And let's have a think about them now together. So, you know, I think Peter Banks in these two albums is a little bit of a puzzle. And I'm just wondering, why is it, do you think, that he's low in the mix in the first album and then in some ways even lower, even less prominent in the second album? What do you think was going on?
On the first album, I kind of almost get the impression that because they were uncertain of what the Yes sound proper is, there's always seems to be a kind of tendency to take it safe with the guitars, you know, and let's not put them too loud, you know, to, you know, scare off potential listeners. Let's keep it at a nice, comfortable volume. You know what I mean? That seems to be the case a lot of the times, unless you're a known band to be like, you know, this guy is like the, you know, the main featured attraction. Let's put him up louder in the mix sort of thing. Right. Mm. But I think that was the case in the first album. But in the case in the second album, I think the orchestra played a lot to do with that. I mean, an orchestra is a pretty full sounding thing, and that can really swallow up a lot of sound.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you're right, and we'll come back to Time and a Word in a minute. But let's just think about a bit more about the first album. Mm-hmm. I agreed with you. I really did recognise the amazing high energy. And as you said, it's the first album. They want to, you know, they're excited about it. It's fantastic to get into a proper studio and make some real recordings. And as you pointed out, they were going out for a wide distribution of this first album, even though it wasn't particularly successful. The chance was there to make a huge impact with the first album. And so that combined with the other thing which I noticed as well was the amount of rehearsal that clearly went into this. They were very well practiced on all this material, and a lot more, and there was a lot more complexity than I had remembered in the first album. And I suppose that was because they were always from the beginning trying to move into new areas, to innovate, to push forward, and they're never content just to take the easy route. And it made me think of other bands, and with other bands, you know, they kind of made a bit of a feature or whatever of being under rehearsed, of going in and trying to sound raw in the studio. Do you think even at this stage, Yes were, you know, very, very deliberate about rehearsing a lot and getting it perfect before they went into the studio?
Yeah, I think that was definitely high on their list of important priorities, because I remember hearing lots of times, and I'm sure you've heard it lots of times too, where John would refer back to seeing like King Crimson play and say, we got to rehearse better, or they saw another band and we have to rehearse better. There's always that strive to be, you know, that much better than the next band, you know. Mm-hmm. There's sort of that competition within the circle of bands, like who is the best performing band and stuff like that, you know. And I think that they took it very, very seriously, because, you know, even back then, they had a lot of songs that were, you know, tricky arrangements. You know, they weren't exactly just, you know, verse, chorus, right?
No.
So you had to make sure that you had that down pat. And back then and this time, you know, you're recording on maybe 8-track tape, maybe 16 if you're lucky. So you got to perform a lot of this stuff live off the floor and then maybe just overdub the vocals kind of thing. So you can't just go in and say, okay, well, the drums are good, we can just go back and fix everything else. Mm. You got to be prepared as a band to get this down on tape, like, well.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Because at this time, And I'm not in any way saying that the first album sounds safe. It doesn't. There's a lot of, as we've already said, energy and so on going into it, the performances. And a lot of the performances are very confident, which I'll come back to in a moment. But I'm just wondering how much of a difference, and we've discussed this before, how much a difference there was between the stage antics of Peter Banks, for example, compared with the versions that they committed to vinyl in this first album, and you know, whether again that was deliberate, were they trying to make a definitive version of these songs, which then they were happy to let Peter Banks or whoever, you know, take a few more liberties with in terms of solos and as I say, antics and falling off the stage and lying down on his back and playing the guitar and so on. So do you think they always had this difference between studio versions and live versions?
Yeah, I mean, early on, I think so. I mean, I think, well, even throughout their whole career, I think that was kind of the case. I mean, I think later on, it was just more that they were just such great musicians that they would always better the performances as they got on. But back here, though, I think a lot of it had to do with the producer, too, because I remember hearing and reading a lot of times that they were saying that, you know, oh, there's some kind of noise coming on the tape. It's coming from the guitar. Let's turn it down a bit. Or we got to clean up his guitar sound. I think a lot of it has to do with that, you know, you can't exactly go into a studio and start, you know, windmilling your arms and flopping around on the floor because there's so many microphones around and stuff. You're going to pick up every little nuance and every little bump that you do when you're doing that kind of stuff. So I don't think that they purposefully tried to make a safer sounding record. I think it was just a matter of the producer was saying, listen, you know, we got to make sure that the guitar doesn't have so much noise coming off it, because it's easy to get a lot of, you know, noise, like static noise from patch cords and stuff like that. So they really had to work on it, right, to get that nice clean sound. Because that's one thing about that record that I had to give them. It's a very clear, very punchy sounding album, and it sounds very, very good, like even on CD and stuff like that, where you can really pick up on that sort of, you know, noise floor.
Yeah, I agree. It does sound great. You know, but I did mention there were a couple of moments perhaps where particularly the vocals I thought weren't quite handled as they could have been, and certainly were later in the band's career. But overall, I agree with you. Yeah, really, really good recording. The two musicians I was going to mention, and I don't know if this was because they were the founders of the band or whether this was just because of their characters or whatever, were Anderson and Squire. And as you said, I mean, he had done quite a bit of recording, so he was pretty comfortable when he went into this. But this was important, and he certainly didn't seem to shrink away from those vocal responsibilities. And Squire as well, extraordinary that he'd hit the road sprinting, as it were, and creating these lines and blistering and complex and interesting bass lines right from this first record. So would you say that Anderson and Squire were, you know, stuck out?
Yeah, I definitely think that they're more of the standout musicians on this record for sure, mainly because I think that when people heard Chris Squire's bass sound, you're probably like, whoa, okay, that's a little different. I mean, sure, you had John Entwistle who had something around that sort of sound, but not as, I don't think it's is exactly the same. But, you know, Chris Squire definitely has a distinctive sound, and the way he plays definitely makes him stand out. I mean, right from the very opening song, you know, he's right there in your face.
Opening
right?
notes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, so I think that that's one of the reasons why that it is. I mean, I don't think that he went in saying, I'm going to be the one to stand out on this album. I think that it was just how it was when they wrote the songs. And John, having the experience that he had with the Warriors and in his other situations where he was already, you know, a live performer and he had some experience recording, I think that, you know, he knew what to expect to some degree when he went to record. So he was probably one of the more, you know, prepared people in there. I mean, you have Bill Bruford, who was a fairly young guy, but, you know, a very, you know, talented drummer. And then you had Tony Kaye, and then you had Peter Banks, you know. And Peter always said that he always had issues in the studio when he was with Yes, because there was always something, you know, and this and that. And he had to battle with orchestras and that. So he never had a great experience with it. Yeah. But I think, you know, Tony Kaye, he did a good job. He was never really buried, I found, at least not in that first record.
No.
So, yeah, but, you know, those two are the featured people. That's pretty safe to say.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. So just moving on to Time in a Word then. Now, I think we've discussed this before, but in the context of these two albums and one leading on from the other, what's difference do you think there would have been? How would they compare if they had made the decision not to use the orchestra in the end? Do you think that the one might be more similar to the first record, or very different, or what do you think?
I think it would have been different. I think it would have been a little bit more guitar centric. I think that they would have been a little bit more of Peter Banks in it, because I think by this point he kind of had a feel of what he was, you know, doing within the band as far as performance and where he kind of sat, right? And I also think that the introduction of Eddie Alford at this point made the sound overall much better on the album. While I still found that there was a little too much low mid bottom end on that record, just for my taste, right? But overall, it's a very, very good sounding record. Definitely a step up, I think. And I think that, you know, having the orchestra away would have gave a little bit more spotlight on Tony, because a lot of the stuff that he did on the organ and the piano, the orchestra kind of mimicked, right? Or played on top of, so you didn't get to experience it as much. I mean, The Prophet, I mean, I love that song.
Yeah.
Such great organ playing on that song.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
So I think that it would have been maybe even that much better. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the orchestra. I never disliked the orchestra. I think it always adds a bit of color to it. But it does sometimes step on a few toes.
Yes, yes. And very much as Steve Howe would say many years later on Magnification. And yes, I also love that Hammond stuff on The Prophet is just fantastic. And I love the piano quintet arrangement, which I think is really, really strong. And certainly the songs were more mature, I can see that. The one that, you know, really for the first time I started thinking this time was the title song, Time and a Word. Does it seem slightly out of place to you? And I in my piece, I really came to the decision that maybe it's not actually a Yes song and really wouldn't fit in on any album. What do you think?
Yeah, it does seem kind of plain Jane compared to the rest of them. I mean, you listen to some of the songs that were on the record, I mean, before we get to that song. Like we just mentioned now a second ago, the Prophet, great song, you know, fantastic performance by Tony Kaye on the organ and just in general with the band. But then you have Astral Traveler.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
What a great song that is. And such a complex middle part, you know, that whole breakdown part is just absolutely fantastically performed. And then you come from that into a simple strummed, you know, Time in a Word. Very basic, very simple. It's almost like on one point, I almost got the feeling that they put that on there as kind of like a sigh, like a, okay, it's all done. Like kind of like, you know, here's a little thing to just ease your ears after that whole huge performance of all this music that we gave you before. This is something to kind of ease you out of the record.
Yes, and I'm just wondering if it really does stick out. So let us know on the sleeve notes if you think that does stick out. I mean, I like it very much. And as I said, I've found myself humming that around the house an awful lot. I think it's catchy and I think it's a good song. But whether it's a real proper Yes song, I'm not quite so sure. And I was just thinking about what other sort of sing-along, single-type songs Yes have done. I mean, I think we can dismiss 90125 and Owner and that sort of thing. I mean, in this sort of era, this 70s era, and the only other one I can think of really is Wondrous Stories. But again, that has complexity in it that this doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but the funny thing is, I think another song that would be qualify as sort of like an easy sing-along song would be I've Seen All Good People, for sure. It's like a simple thing at the beginning. But, you know, the song I think itself is good, and it all depends, I think, on the people around it. And I'll give you an example. The version of Time and a Word on Keys to Ascension is fantastic. Like Rick Wakeman's piano on that version just puts it up like four or five steps, in my opinion, just to hear that. I really think it's a fantastic version. It's probably one of my favorite versions of that song.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great version, and I still do like it. Well, what about the two albums then? I mean, as usual with Yes, two albums which in some ways are really very different, and not just because the orchestra is there on Time and a Word, but from other angles that we've already discussed as well. I'm not sure which one I prefer. I think it would be perhaps much more difficult if there wasn't the orchestra on Time and a Word, because I think the two would be a lot more similar in approach. So it's even more difficult now that that decision was taken to include the orchestra. And I suppose if I had to choose my favourite out of the two, I would probably go for Time and a Word. But that doesn't mean to say I don't have a very soft place in my heart for the first album, and particularly the things that we've talked about, the amazing bass lines, the origins of the Yes sound, let's not forget that, the vocal harmonies and so on, which really were set up and set the standard for, I suppose, in that first album. And we certainly couldn't have had Time and a Word without having the first album. So it really is a toss-up, but I suppose I would have to go for Time and a Word in the end.
Yeah, and I agree with that as well. I think Time and a Word is the slightly better. As much as I love the first record, I listened to it quite a bit. Actually, I've always kind of liked pulling out the old orange vinyl special edition one of it and putting it on.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And but the thing about Time and a Word, besides the fact that it's such a great album, is that the kind of history behind it, I think, kind of also made me step it up a bit too. I mean, they had that German pressing of it that has a different mix of No Opportunity Necessary and has a different track order. It has, you know, it also has Dear Father on it, which is not on the original version of it. So Time and a Word kind of has like an interesting, quirky history to it, which I think kind of lends to why I like it a little bit more too, because, you know, if I want to hear a slightly different version of that album, I can just go grab my either record store day version or the original German pressing of it that I have and have a Time and a Word that's not the same as the one that came out. How many other Yes albums can you say that, you know?
That's true. That's true. And it has also lots of other stories as well, doesn't it, about it. For example, the David Foster idea that he plays that acoustic guitar at the beginning of the last song there, and also some backing vocals. And oh yeah, it's got some great stories.
Multiple album covers.
Yeah, multiple album covers with the wrong artists on some of them. Yeah, that's right. So it's all good fun. And those amazing videos as well. We must go back and do an episode about videos, actually. We're long overdue for that. Okay, well, another great example of comparing two albums, and remember to have your say on those as well on the show notes for this week. But for the moment, Mark, thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome, Kevin.